Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. It's my pleasure to introduce Robert B. I've been knowing him for several years, and he's very involved in recovery and service work. Can I give you Robert?
Thank you, Lisa. My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here at NABA. It's great to be here at the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting again. It's maybe the first time I've been here of late, but it's great to be here and telling my story and getting a chance to talk to a variety of people. And there's people here that I see and that I know, people I sponsor, people I used to sponsor, friends I've had for a long time, and people that are just not friends yet. So I do need to ask a question just before I get going. How many people are in their first 90 days of sobriety? Raise your hand. Great. Here's a similar question, a really good one. Is there anybody here in their last 90 days of sobriety? I say that because I showed up prematurely at AA about 9 years before I got sober. And I was in my first 90 days and my last 90 days of sobriety at the same time. I didn't even know it. And I'll get to how that happens to people in a little bit. But, you know, I like to come to meetings and say that I'm a member of good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. What that means is I've got a sobriety date. It's April 10th, 2001. I've got a home group. It's the Fit Tradition group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet up at Ember Hills United Methodist Church. We have a big speaker meeting on Saturday night at 7 p.m. A big book study at 8, but it's moving to 7 p.m. just because I guess we're all getting older, have to get home sooner or something like that. I don't know what it is, but it'll start at 7 p.m. in March. So we'd love to have you all join us for any of those. But I have a sponsor, Pat M. I sponsor guys, and I sponsor people really since my first year of sobriety, and that's a true blessing. I do service work in AA, you know, in my home group. I take service commitments every month, and I do service work in other areas of AA, sort of like being here. And I do service work in other areas of my life. And I think when I put all those things together, it means I'm a member of good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it doesn't mean anything more than that. It doesn't mean I'm an expert on or an authority on or anything. It just means that, you know, when a guy like me that's an alcoholic of the type that the Big Book talks about shows up at AA and does what people say, you get a chance to be sober and get a chance to be engaged and get to really enjoy and participate in your life. And I'm really glad my wife's here, too. We were talking. She says, well, I've heard his story before. I said, well, you hadn't heard it this year yet, you know, so... So I'm glad she's here, too, and she'll end up in the story. So, you know, one thing that I really have to make clear, though, when I tell you my name's Robert and I'm an alcoholic, that's the most important thing you'll hear about me, and there's a lot of other roles and responsibilities I have in my life. You know, as I mentioned, I'm married, I have a wife, I have a son, Stuart, I have a son, Kyle, I have brother, Scott, I have parents, I'm employed, I have people I report to, I have people that report to me, but all of that is sort of meaningless if I don't take care of that whole alcoholism thing. And why do I think I'm an alcoholic? Well, it's because of the special relationship I have with alcohol. See, something happens to me when I start drinking alcohol. It's not like anything else. When I start drinking, I'm the kind of guy, I drink till I get drunk, and then I keep on drinking. That's when the good drinking really happens. It's once you start, it just keeps going. And all sorts of things happen, and, you know, it doesn't happen to me with any other things that I drink. You know, I remember when I was new, a sponsor asked me, what's something else I like to drink? And I said, Diet Coke. He said, you ever sit down and drink a case of Diet Coke? I said, no, I've never done that. He said, you ever go lock yourself in a hotel with a couple of cases of Diet Coke? I said, no, I haven't done that either, you know? See, I know some of y'all have evidently enjoyed that effect of alcohol that I was just talking about. And the book says we're bodily and mentally different. And I'll give some examples of that. But more importantly, see, there's this other thing that happens with alcohol. When I'm not drinking it, and I hadn't drank it for a while, my mind starts talking to me. It tells me stories. It says things like, if you hadn't gotten on 285, you wouldn't have gotten a DUI. It says this time you'll only have two. It says this time your wife won't divorce you. And these are the kind of things that happen. You know, I end up in the hospital, all sorts of things. And yet once I started drinking and got to that active drinking where it's almost every day, I could not stop drinking. That thought process overawed all of the thoughts, and I kept drinking from really the time I was a teenager until I got sober, which was in my early 40s. So we're asked to come here and tell a little bit about what we're like, what happened, what we're like now, and that's exactly what I'm due. But I'm really glad how they read at this meeting that one of the main points of telling our story is how we develop a relationship with a higher power, and that's going to be key too, because that's the only way I stay sober, by the grace of a loving God. So, I was born right here in Atlanta, down at a hospital, used to be called Georgia Baptist, it's Atlanta Medical now, and I had loving parents. They took me home, and they took care of me, and they gave me good educational training and good religious training, and I knew right from wrong, and you know, my mom was a greater disciplinarian. She disciplined by way of the bolo paddle. You know, the application of the bolo paddle, it would keep me in line. And my dad was, he was described in business as honest as the day is long. And so I was taught right from wrong. And really, I sort of tried to follow that path as a little kid. And I was like most little kids. There's times when I was anxious and unsure, didn't want to public speak, and I'd be scared of what they might ask me at school and all this kind of stuff. And I fit in with other kids. You know, I played sports and did okay in school. And, you know, life went along. And, you know, there came that day where it was that fateful first drink. And it happened when I was 15 years old. And I was with my buddy Rex with high school. I grew up in the Chastain Park area. And we're there at the high school. We'd been playing basketball as hot as sweaty. And the McClellan brothers pulled up in their van. And the McClellan brothers were older than us. We were 15. But this one was 18. One was 17. Jim and John. And these were guys that were cool. We looked up to these guys. They played in a band. They had long hair. Sort of like you now. And they talked about having sex with women. All sorts of stuff. Now, if I was talking about having sex with women, it was strictly in my mind. It had been, you know, single person sex, if anything at all. So when they said, Robert and Rex, you want to go out and have a couple beers? We said, you bet. We jumped in that van, and I think I was going to have a couple beers. You know, I'd see my dad drinking beers or having a couple drinks. He'd get home from work, have those couple beers, read the paper, have dinner, go to bed, get up, go to work the next day. I get in that van, I think that's what's going to happen. I had 2, 3, 4 beers, and this was an old Volkswagen van. It might have only been running on 3 cylinders, and the sound system wasn't that good. But all of a sudden, after 6, 8, or 10 beers, it was like we're in a limousine, and the music got better, you know. It was really something. It affected everything. It just became, you know, the solution to all my problems. And whatever concerns, if there's any anxiety I had about going out and talking with these guys, it was all gone. It was a great night, and nothing bad happened that I can remember anyway. And the second thing that makes me alcoholic happened too. I knew I was going to do it again. And, you know, the great thing was the drinking age in Georgia back then was 18. It was easily accessible. People had older brothers. We'd get our hands on booze. So I started drinking on the weekends, and we'd get chances, you know, sometimes in the morning before school, we'd get to school early. And the parents would think he's going to school early, like he's going to study. But I'd be meeting up with Rex and David and some other buddies, and we'd be all bringing some beer, whatever we'd get our hands on, and having a few drinks before school. And, you know, that drinking led to other things. This drinking started off, this was right after Woodstock. That's the age range in which I grew up. And so I can remember I was driving around with my buddy Drew. We're in his Triumph TR6. I was in the passenger seat, and he says, Robert, look in the glove compartment. So I open up the glove compartment, and this bag of weed falls out. And I pull it out, and he says, open it up. And I open it up, and it's one of those sandwich bags, not the Ziploc kind like you have now, but the kind you lick across there. 10 or 20 people have licked it, you know. And I pulled out some of the joints that were already rolled up in there, and we start smoking, and they started popping and cracking. It had seeds and stems in it. And it was burning our shirts. Y'all have smoked that weed, I can see. You know, I don't think I fell in love with smoking weed, but man, it enhanced the effect of alcohol, man. So I started drinking, I smoked a pot, and pot was easily accessible. And, you know, you start doing that, before you know it, you're doing other things too. I started dating this girl, Sherry, who came to our school when I was in 11th grade, I guess. And I started dating her, and I went over to her house, and her parents were in the front of the house, and she says, come to the back of the house with me. thought, this sounds good. So we go to the back of the house, and she says, come into that bedroom. We go in, and she locks the door. So I'm thinking, this is getting better and better. And then she went through this ritual that I'd never seen live before, maybe on TV. And she put out this mirror, and she dumped this powder on it. She chopped it all up, and she pulled out this straw, and she batted her brown eyes at me and said, if you snort this with me, I'll let you feel my boobs. Well, you can imagine what happened. I ended up drinking and doing drugs for another 25 years. So this was my introduction into alcoholism. And often here is where people start apologizing for drug use, and I don't really feel a need to apologize for drug use to a group of alcoholics who probably have done the same thing, because most of the time it was intermittent, in between drunken binges or during those drunken binges. And here's how I can tell you I know I'm alcoholic. I described it at the beginning of the meeting, but there was one time when I was out of college and I was making good money, and me and friends would go down to a place called the Buckhead Saloon, and on a hot summer night, I can remember, I'd get a Heineken beer, and you can just picture that Heineken beer in that green bottle with the white and green and red and black label. And on a hot summer night, the condensation is just rolling down, and you just take a sip of it, and you just guzzle it down. You guzzle down four or five or six, and man, you just love what it's doing for you. It made me feel great. But another time, I can remember, I was still in high school with my buddy Monroe, and we were going to go play golf. And it was March, maybe April. You know, it was the first time we were playing golf after the winter. So we go into his closet, pull the golf clubs out. It's one of those golf bags that had a big old section for the golf shoes and things to go in. We looked in there because the clubs were really heavy. And we opened it up, and there was about eight or nine old Milwaukee tall boys in there. They'd been there since autumn. So they were old, they were flat, and they were hot. But you know what? We opened them up and drank them. You know why? Because I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, when I read that in the doctor's opinion, it says we like the effect, but I love the effect produced by alcohol. See, that's why I know I'm alcoholic. Man, once I start drinking, I just can't stop. I love it, and I start up every time. And there is some drug use here and there, and, you know, impact my story. But I think I wanted to just say that. I think when we tell our stories, we have to tell the truth. But I'm alcoholic through and through. I don't describe as anything else. And once I found the solution to my alcoholism, I found out it solved all my problems. So anyway, a few stories about my drinking. I can remember when I was a teenager in high school, my buddy David and I were supposed to be heading down to Jekyll Island. We played baseball in Athens. We're supposed to drive down and meet some other buddies in Jekyll Island, meet there for a service club. And so we finished the game. We're driving down there. Drinking age is 18. We were 18, so we're driving down there. We pick up some beer, and we're eating sandwiches, having a good time. We're in my family car, and I'm driving. And David says, Robert, why don't you let me drive? I said, sure. You know, I'm thinking, this is great. He'll drive. I can just sort of drink the way I want to. And so David's driving down, and he's evidently not as good a drunk driver as he thought he was. And he gets pulled over. You know, those blue lights hit, and it's, oh, my God, what are we going to do? So we pull over, and they arrest him for DUI. They throw me in jail for public drunkenness. And he lets me know that his parents are out of town, and I'm going to have to call my parents. And see, my dad was expecting a phone call from some hotel on Jekyll Island. He was not expecting a call from the Glenn County jail saying we need bail money. And so when he took the call, I mean, I could hear it in his voice. I could tell he was really upset. He didn't scream and yell, but he says, Robert, I'm going to send that money, but you and David be at the house at 5 o'clock on Sunday, because he knew we were getting through at noon. That'd give us enough time to get back. He didn't want to give us time to screw around. So we show up the next morning with our friends, come up with some story while we're late, and, you know, we leave at noon, we drive back, and we're really scared. What's my dad going to say? And so we pull up, and of all things, David's parents are there, my parents are there, they're sitting on the front porch, and they read us the Riot Act, as good parents should. And they talked about the problems of drinking and driving. You could have killed yourself, you could have killed someone else, it'll be on your permanent record. And now, they go through all this stuff, and they talk David and me into promising we're not going to drink anymore. And I tell you this story, because if you had watched David drink, when he was drinking beer, he was knocking out the beers left and right just like me. If we were doing shooters, he'd be doing those shooters just the way I was. And watching us drink, you'd have thought we were the same kind of people. But you know, he made that promise, and he was able to keep. And the Big Book talks about a certain type of drinker, a hard drinker, to give them sufficient reason they can stop or moderate. I promise too. You know, a weekend or so later, I'm drinking again. Because I'm the type the book talks about as a real alcoholic. And what I found out when I got to AA, I had to diagnose myself. Am I really an alcoholic? Because if I'm really an alcoholic, I need to come here and do the things people in AA do. If I'm not, I'm just a hard drinker. I'll stop when I really have to. And that's an important distinction. And I still see David today, and he's still not drinking today. You know, it's sort of a miracle. I couldn't believe it, you know. But I just keep on drinking. I get out of high school, and I go into college, and I go to this four-year school in North Carolina, and I spent through that four-year school in a mere 72 months. I took the extended program of getting through, but I could get through school for a variety of reasons. One reason was I could take tests. You give me a multiple choice test, and I'm good at it. It's like, who wants to be a millionaire? You do 50-50, you knock some out, and come up with the right answer. You give me a written test, I'm pretty good. If I pay attention at all, I can come up with something I can write. But you give me an oral test, and I got the other person lit, because I got three or four people in my head talking it all the time, you know? So I got out of that college and made my way back to Atlanta, and I found out there was one test that I could not pass. That was a field sobriety test. And unfortunately, I failed that thing three times. I was about 24, 25 years old at that point. And I found myself in real trouble. These days, they'd just lock you up and that'd be it. And I don't even like to make light of it because it's serious. Someone will probably die tonight somewhere of a DUI. But anyway, I hired this attorney. And this attorney, he knew the judge, all this kind of stuff. And he says, Robert, we're going to meet in the judge's chambers, and I'll do all the talking. I'm thinking, no joke, I give you all that money. Of course you're doing all the talking. He says, but if he asks you a specific question, I sort of give you the nod, you can go ahead and answer it. So I'll never forget, we go in that judge's chamber. I've got the three DUIs, and he's looking at the citations. There's more than three citations because I ran into cars and stuff like that. That's the kind of thing that happens when you really get drunk and drive. And I like drinking and driving, so... he was looking at those citations. He also had this big tractor feed of other arrests that I'd had because I'd had a number of public drunkenness and drunken disorderly and just the kind of stuff that happens to alcoholics. And this judge looked at me and he said, Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I thought, no, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating. That's a real problem, you know? But he had a point, and the point was there's objective evidence. You seem to drink beyond the limit. You're willing to drive, which is against the law. And, you know, it'd been great if he'd asked those follow-up questions. A follow-up question would be is maybe you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, try and get some help. Maybe you should go to treatment. Maybe you should go see a psychologist or you know. There's all sorts of things, but the fix was in. So, you know, I don't know what money went from my attorney to the judge or any of that kind of stuff. But all I know is I left there and I did not have to, you know, pay any particular penalty beyond financial. But I did know I didn't want to go back in front of the judge for any DUIs. I knew that for sure. So, you know, I was trying to avoid that. But I was back drinking, you know, probably that night. I don't remember specifically. But anyway, that drinking sort of continued. And I was the kind of drinker that every now and then I'd put on a, you know, tie one on really bad. And I had one of those times where I got drunk on a Tuesday, and I didn't sort of pull out of it till a Saturday. You know, that whole cocaine and Quaaludes, all that stuff. I mean, you just have those kind of nights. And I pulled out, and I said, this has got to stop. You know, it's got to stop. But I never particularly heard of AA. I didn't think about going to AA. I probably heard of it, you know, in a sociology class or something. So anyway, but I'd gone to church growing up. I thought, maybe I'll go to church. Maybe that'll help. And so I go to church, and I didn't really find my solution to alcoholism. And people asked questions. They wanted to be helpful and things like that. But what did happen is I met my first wife. Carrie's my second wife. I met my first wife, Teresa, there. You know, when a woman like that meets a man like me, it's the end of all her troubles. It's the front end of all our troubles is what it is. Because here's this, what the kind of thing that would happen. It would be a night like tonight, and it would have been 6 o'clock, and I'd call home and say, you know, Teresa, I'll be home. I'm going to stop and have a couple beers with my buddy Jesse. What we're going to do is watch a little bit of the NBA game that's coming on early, and I'll be on home. We're going to leave at halftime. See, I didn't know about this stuff that I learned about here in AA, phenomenon of craving, all that jazz. I have a couple beers. Next thing I think, well, I want to get a better buzz on. I'll have a couple shots. Next thing I know is, we'll just see what's going on in SportsCenter during halftime. Before I know it, the game's over, and it's 11 p.m., and I haven't called home because I don't want to upset anybody at home, and I've really fouled up dinner. And my wife is upset. She's put dinner away. I try and just sneak home and, you know, slide into the house and avoid all the trouble that I can. And I show up at AA or a treatment center. And they say stuff to me like, Robert, is your drinking hurting anybody? And I say, you know what? If it's hurting anybody, it's only hurting me. If you'd asked my former wife, if you'd asked my brother, if you'd asked people I work for, people that work for me, or people really anywhere, any circle of contact I had, they could describe the pain and suffering I was causing them, not to mention my own pain and suffering. But see, the book tells me I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, that that's the root of my trouble. But I just can't see it when I'm active in my alcoholism. I can barely see it sober, but I can see it now, and I know what to do about it now. You know, I need help from God. That's the solution. So, you know, we want to have kids, and my wife and I were trying to have kids, and she wasn't getting pregnant. She goes to the doctor, and they says, your husband needs to get a full physical, too. And so I go in, they do a bunch of tests on me, a bunch of tests on her. As they're testing me, they find out that I've got something wrong, an abdominal abscess, and they have to take it out. And they said, it's not something that we can just do here. You know, we're actually going to have to go to the hospital. I said, okay, let's schedule it. They do. And they said, we're going to have to do some blood work, come in next week. And so I go in for the blood work, and they said, you're going to have to stay in for 2 nights at least. And I said, stay overnight? What in the world for? And they said, well, this abdominal incision is going to be quite painful, and the only way we can take care of the pain is by providing narcotics overnight while you're in the hospital. I said, whatever. And I said, well, when I get out, will I be okay? And they said, no, it'll still be painful. I said, well, what are we going to do about that? They said, we have an appropriate treatment for that, and that's it'll be narcotic medication, which we'll provide to you. I thought, well, that's not all bad. And so I go get that operation, and I'm taking these pain pills when I get out of the hospital. And I noticed they take 2 every 4 hours, but I thought, well, I'll try 4 and see what happens. And I found that I got this sense of ease and comfort that I sort of got like when I was drinking. And I came up with a plan. And what the plan was, my wife didn't like my drinking, you know. I'd be bad to drink at times, but I travel for a living, and so I came up with a plan. Here's the plan. When I'm on the road, sort of Monday through Thursday, I'd be able to drink the way that I want to. Stay out late, get up, have a drink or two before work, maybe have some drinks during work, but then get back home, and when I'm in town, I'll just pop these pills. It sounds like a good plan. And if you've got a plan, what you should do is tell someone your plan. Because if your plan was like my plan, it's not a good plan, because there's a couple fallacies. The first one is, when you're laying on the floor unconscious, it doesn't matter whether you smell like booze or not. They know something's up. And I've had problems because I went through these pills a little too fast. That's the other part of the problem I had. So I called my primary care physician, and I says, you know, I had this abdominal surgery. It's painful. He recognized the level of pain I was in, and he prescribed some of these pills. And I had some other doctors that I knew about. I'd never visited before, but I visited with them, and they knew about the pain of abdominal surgery, and they prescribed too. But the real problem comes in is somewhere down the road, people start saying, you don't need these pills anymore. But see, I'm a keen observer of society, and I noted one of these doctors had left prescription pads in that small little waiting room. Not the big one, the small little one. And so I picked them up. And I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a pharmacist, but I do write prescriptions. And you see, I found that I not only had times where there was imminent pain, but there could be some anxiety about writing these prescriptions, too. And I might need pills for anxiety. Sometimes I couldn't go to sleep. Sometimes I couldn't get up. So next thing I know, I'm writing prescriptions for just about everything. And I'm drinking. And my wife is upset about it all. And it just gets worse from here, too. Because, you know, you break any law. If you run down there to the end of Briarwood and take a right without stopping at that stop sign, if you do that every time you come to meeting here, sooner or later a policeman's going to be there and arrest you. And that's what happened to me, is sooner or later they caught on that these were forged prescriptions, and I got arrested. And I could have avoided the pain that was about to follow if I just followed directions. I could have gotten off on a first offense and just stayed clear of the law for 1 year. But, you know, I had no defense against the first drink. Didn't want to stop doing those drugs either. And so before it's all over with, It's amazing to even stand here and say, but I got arrested for robbing a drugstore. And it wasn't like I went in with a pistol and said, stick them up. But it was a little bit like that. And and I got arrested for battery and assault. And, you know, they sort of tried to throw the book at me. And it's hard to imagine. I, you know, end up getting an attorney. And I got an attorney. This was in Cobb County. I was one of these on the school. Oh, no. You've been there, too. So anyway, this is one of those attorneys who's on the square. He was law partners with Roy Barnes, a former governor. This is a bigwig attorney. And so, you know, plus he charged a lot of money, so I knew he could do the job. But he did murder trials and stuff like this. So he went and plea bargained. The best he could do was he could plea bargain me down to from the 4 felonies down to 2 with 10 years to serve. And he called me into his office and he says, Robert, we've done the best we can, but I'm afraid it's going to be 4, from 4 felonies down to 2, and you're going to have served 2 years in prison. And I thought for a second, and here's what I said. You know, I'm really more of a jail guy than a prison guy. I can take 30 days. But this, start talking years, you know, it's out of my range. But anyway. So that attorney sent me to AA. This was 1992, and you may remember my sobriety date is 2001. So I went to my first AA meeting in January of 1992. It was a Sunday night. It was in a church out there in Cobb County. There's linoleum floors and folding chairs and tables. And it was about 5:30 p.m., and it was Sunday at the end of January, and it was Super Bowl Sunday, and I was at AA. And I can tell you, I was not happy, joyous, and free, but people were there. People in AA were there. They were there to share the message of hope and recovery, and, you know, that's the thing that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had not bought into that third tradition yet. We read it tonight. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. See, I didn't have that desire. And AA does not work real well if you don't have a desire to stop drinking. But once you get that desire, it's great. So anyway, I started going to AA meetings. I started doing what my attorney said. And at that time, the state of Georgia had bad prison overcrowding. And the district attorney called me in with my attorney. And he read me the Riot Act. He says, we're going to give you a break. We're going to put you on 1 year of intensive probation and 10 years of probation. And if you come in here for any violation, you know, you're going straight to state prison. And I'd like to say it scared me straight, but it didn't. I sort of found ways to keep drinking and doing the stuff I was doing. And, you know, I didn't violate, and I got through that probation. I want to get to where I sober up, because there's some good parts of my story there, too. So I dodged that whole thing, and while I'm on probation, interestingly enough, we decide that we can't have kids, so we ended up filing, you know, trying to adopt, and we go through an adoption agency, and we got a phone call. I'll never forget it. It was in April 28th, that little baby boy was born down in Thomasville, and so, did you want to come get him? We says, you bet. And we drive down there the next day and pick him up. And that little baby boy was in a laundry basket, there's towels in there, and he was screaming bloody murder. He'd just been circumcised. I can imagine screaming bloody murder. And we picked that baby up and threw him in the car, in that car seat that we had, and I can tell you, that was one time, among many, where I thought, this is the time I need to stop drinking and stop doing drugs. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a father to this kid. I want to do the things that men want to do, that people want to do, men or women, when they've got a new child. I want to live the way and give them the kind of things my parents gave me. So we drive back up to Atlanta, and my in-laws were there, and my parents were there, and my brother was there with his wife, and there's some other kids there. There's a bit of commotion. There's a little bit of anxiety. And, you know, I don't know if it'll take that edge off. And before I knew it, within a day or so, you know, I'm just going to have a beer or two. And one beer or two leads to more. And, you know, I'm back sort of doing the same old thing. But I think every alcoholic has those crossroads where you say, I really have got to quit. And I mean it with every fiber of my soul. And I meant it. But see, the willpower was not there. You know, the willpower just wasn't there. So just to roll on up to my sobriety date, it was April, it was 2001, and it was spring break. This kid had grown up to like 14 years old, and we go down to Tampa, Florida to visit some friends, and my wife gets a phone call on Wednesday where she needs to get back to work by Thursday. So we pack up and come back, and she goes to work. I get back on Wednesday night, and I used to meet some buddies at the Buckhead Saloon, and so I show up there, and I'm late. I don't get there until like 9 o'clock, and, you know, they're already drinking and having a good time. So I end up trying to catch up by doing some shooters and stuff like that, and so I tied one on. It wasn't a big drunk, but, you know, I tied one on, and I go home, and I figure if my wife's going to work, I'll go to work too, save my vacation day so we can, you know, enjoy vacation together. And so I get up the next day, and not feeling too good, but I go to work, and I know what to do about that. I'm still using those pain pills now and then, so I take a handful of those pills, take it with a cup of coffee. It's about 7:30, and I'm walking around sort of in the lobby area of work, and all of a sudden I get this feeling I'm getting woozy, and I've gotten this before. Next thing I know, boom, I'm down on the floor, and I'm sort of flopping around like this, and I can hear in the background, call 911, call 911, Robert's down, and I was down, and I was sort of shaking, and, you know, I get hauled off in an ambulance, and I can remember I get to the hospital, and I wake up, and it's interesting, back then, you'd be in the hospital, and I saw these people around me, they were clinicians, they all had on masks. Not like today. You look around, you see people with masks these days. But back then, you knew someone was up when you saw a person with a mask. And they're saying, breathe, Mr. Bell, breathe. And, you know, I was sort of, I was trying to come to and come out of that. And I told them what I'd done, that I'd taken some pills and all this. And they said, you've got to call somebody. And so I called my wife, Teresa, my former wife, and said, Teresa, I'm at the hospital. I took some pills and, you know, I went unconscious. And she asked me this question. It's a really great question. She says, Robert, is there any hope? Is there any hope? And that became like a tipping point. Is there any hope? You know, here in AA, we have to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living. It was a tipping point. You know, we have to believe in the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It became a tipping point. We have to concede to our innermost selves we're alcoholic. That question, is there any hope, was a real tipping point. I wasn't thinking of that other stuff out of the big book then. You know, I might have been going to meetings, but I wasn't paying attention evidently. But that was a real tipping point question. And so she comes to the hospital, picks me up, and they always give you discharge instructions. The doctor comes in. I'm sitting there with my wife, and there's a nurse there. And the doctor says, Mr. Bell, you told the nurse you took a handful of pills, didn't even count them. Weren't you afraid of an overdose? My thought was, I'm really scared of that dreaded underdose is what I'm scared of, you know? So, you know, my wife shakes her head, and we go home, and my wife was a thoughtful person. I got home, and she had packed my bags. She had sort of had enough, and she had found a place for me to go. I ended up at this place out in East Georgia called Penfield. I hadn't detoxed yet, and after a day or two there, I'm sort of getting shaky, and they send me to, I end up in Peachford. And so I was in the mental institute. This wasn't the first time, but I got to ask a question. How many of y'all ever been to the mental institute? Raise your hand. A lot of you. How many of y'all ever been to jail or prison? Raise your hand. A lot of the same people. So, I really like the mental institute compared to jail. There's a lot of benefits, you know. The food's a lot better. Day room's a lot safer. So while I was there, you know, I can remember two quick stories. I'm going to sort of move on into the recovery a bit more. But two quick stories. While I was there, I can remember a counselor calling me back into his office. Says, Robert, come on back. And so I went in and visited. He says, Robert, have you ever been to AA? And my thought was, isn't everybody in the mental institute going to AA? But I said, yes, I've been to AA. He said, did you ever work the steps? And I can tell you what, I know everybody in this room should know that they're heart of heart if they've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I hadn't. I hadn't gotten on my knees and prayed that third step prayer. I'd not done a written inventory. Certainly hadn't shared it, had not asked God for help with my character defects, had not tried to make amends. So there's a variety of things that I might not have even been able to describe all the steps, but I knew I hadn't. And he said, Robert, did you have a sponsor? And I said, in name. He says, well, let me ask you this. Do you know what Bill did when he finally got sober? What did he do? And I couldn't answer the question. I didn't know. And he pointed out, he says, well, if you take a look in the doctor's opinion, you'll find out that he went back to the place where he detoxed. And he talked about his theory of rehabilitation and talked about it to the patients and said if they wanted to get better, they'd have to do likewise. Of course, I didn't study the big book. Didn't make that much sense to me. Then he asked me this question. He says, Robert, do you think AA can work for you? And I started to give him an answer. He says, no. I just want you to think about that. Then he sent me back to the day room, so I went out and hung out with my colleagues and forgot about all that stuff for a good while. Another thing that happened while I was at Mill Institute is there were members of Alcoholics Anonymous that came to share meetings there, and I can remember I was sitting there with four or five of us that were on suicide watch. They wouldn't let us go to the big meeting, and they sat at a lunch table, and they read off the title page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. See, I think in stories we learn to relate to one another. We hear people's stories. There's parts we can relate to. Maybe not all of it, but I still need to identify with it. Men and women, it's inclusive. It's for everybody. Have recovered to regain our spiritual, mental, and physical health. And it's thousands. Now it's millions, but it's broad-based. And alcoholism, the disease concept. And, you know, I just vaguely remember they read off the title page and talked about it. And so as they're packing up to leave, we're talking about what squares they are coming here. We don't think too much about the fact they're going out and getting dessert and coffee and all that. And we're behind locked doors, you know. So I have a different perspective on it now. But, you know, AA touched me right there at the very beginning of my recovery. So I get out of that, and I head on back to this place, Penfield. I put a treatment center here in Atlanta, halfway house called Mar, and went through feeling school and all this stuff. But the miracle of recovery happened there. Because the very first night I was there, it was a Monday night, I ended up going to my first home group, Peachtree Corners. And I went there. Peachtree Corners then was a real big meeting, probably about as many as these, but it break into five groups. Big book study, newcomers meeting, 12 and 12 meeting, and open discussion, I think. Anyway, I went to the big book study rather than newcomer meeting because I knew the big book was important. I paid attention to the guy who was leading the big book meeting. That's the guy that I asked to be my sponsor. And I'll never forget, he asked several questions. The one that I think is really important, he says, Robert, are you willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcoholism? And I said yes, because I felt it was really important to, you know, impress my sponsor early. And so I said yes. I didn't know what it was going to entail, but he says, great. Well, I want you to meet me here at 7 o'clock on Mondays and Fridays, which is when Peachtree Corners met. And I said, Pat, the meeting's at 8. He said, yeah, the meeting's at 8, but somebody's got to make coffee and put the steps up on the wall and put out the literature and put the chairs out and do all that. And see, I always just showed up at meetings when they started, and I didn't know AA members actually did all that. I thought the church did that stuff, you know. How am I to know? So he not only unlocked the message of the big book, because we'd do all that, and then we'd study the big book, but he also demonstrated what sober members of alcoholics do. And we'd stop about 7:40 to 7:45, and we'd go up to this bridge where everybody would come in, and he'd say, we're going to go up and shake hands with newcomers. Let them know that AA is a good place. It's a safe place. It's a place where they're welcome. We don't care if they're drinking, not drinking, come. We want to help. We want to be there. And so I learned important things from the very beginning. And week after week, we kept going through the big book, and that's the process by which I took the 12 steps. And so, you know, it's interesting. You know, by August, my sobriety date's in April. By August, I take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll never forget, we get to page 88, which is the end of Into Action, and it's right after finish step 11, and we got through with that, and I can remember my sponsor, Pat, looking me in the eye. And he says, Robert, it's time for you to find someone you can help. And I said, how am I going to find them? He says, first of all, you'll pray to find them. I says, what kind of help am I going to give them? He says, you're going to sponsor them. I says, oh, Pat, you got to be wrong here. I go to a lot of meetings where they say you need to have a year. And he says, well, you know, Bill was out trying to find people when he was newly sober. And he found Dr. Bob, you know, when he was, it was May of 1935, Bill got sober in December of 1934, so he was 6 months sober when he found him. Of course, Dr. Bob had another drink, and he didn't sober up until June 10th, which is we celebrate AA's birthday, when those two stayed sober for the rest of their lives. But Dr. Bob was helping AA number 3 17 days later. If they had been waiting a year, you'd be dead. We'd all be dead. He says, it's time for you to find someone to help. And so I started praying to find people I could help. We kept studying the big book. And amazingly enough, you know, I was sponsoring people inside of my first year of sobriety. I've been sponsoring people ever since. And I think that's really one of the great things that has been a blessing in my life. It's been something that's allowed me to, you know, enjoy sobriety, to learn more about me, and to get to know people. And it's really been a blessing. So as time goes on, you stay sober. And actually, pretty quickly, some of the things that happen in life happen. My dad had been living with me. My mom had died probably 8 or 10 years earlier. My dad had been living with me and my wife and and Stuart. And he'd gotten sick. He's 84 years old. He had a pacemaker. He got infected. And he went to the hospital at St. Joseph right up there. And they just couldn't take care of that infection. And I went and saw him on a Saturday morning. It was really early. And he says, you know, he says, this could be it. He says, but there comes a time in every man's life where he has to make peace with God and his fellow man. He says, and I've done that. I made peace with God and his fellow man. And, you know, that was okay for him, but I was distraught about that. But I think about that now. You know, I had to sort of tear my life to the ground and come to AA. And here in AA is where I learned to make peace with God and my fellow man, by taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, all of them, including making those amends. And that's how I did that. My dad had been trying to teach me that his whole life. And I come here and finally learned that from people like you. And so we were able to bury my dad. He did die a couple days later, and we buried him on a Friday. And I'll never forget, I was able to do the family eulogy. You know, I could talk about it to his brother and his sister who were there, and cousins who were there, and other family members. And I knew some of his business friends and things like that. And my wife did a little bit of that too. And then my son Stuart got up and he read the 23rd Psalm, often read at funerals down south anyway. And little would I know that inside of a year, though, we'd be reading the 23rd Psalm at my son's funeral. And Stuart died when he was 15 years old. It was July 26, 2002. I was in my second year of sobriety. And he completed the suicide act. Here's what happened. My wife had come in from running. She said, go downstairs to get Stuart up. It's time for him to get ready for soccer camp. And so I was in the second floor at the bedroom. I went down the first floor and down to the basement. So I went down the steps and I looked ahead. A closet door was open and there was a rope hanging down. And Stuart's feet were on the ground and his knees were bent. And I really thought he was going to stand up. Say, just kidding, Dad. And I ran over and held him. You know, there wasn't going to be any first aid. There wasn't going to be any CPR. He was lifeless. And I sort of went into a brownout then, a sober brownout. I ran up the steps, and I imagine I was yelling. And my former wife jumped out of the shower and said, Robert, what's happened? I said, Stuart's hung himself. And I asked her to call 911. And I picked up the phone, and I called my sponsor, and I said, Pat, Stuart's hung himself. He said, I'll be right over. He had been to my house once or twice, maybe. And so he came on over. And I'll never forget, he came in, and we were standing there making coffee, and I was looking out the front porch. I look out the front window, and Art S. and Matt E. pull up. I said, how do they know? He says, well, I called Matt. He must have called Art. And before I knew it, the home group was there. And they were there just to provide solace and help in a time of need. And, you know, when I think about that time, it was a special time in my life. And Charles Dickens starts a novel and he says, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And you can understand how this was the worst of times. A child that you really wanted and desired and went to the efforts to adopt and had raised and nurtured has died in a tragic and seemingly meaningless way. It just doesn't make sense. How could it possibly be the best of times? Well, the love we were shown by members of Alcoholics Anonymous when they came in and cared for us and got us water and helped us set up the funeral and do all the things that needed to be done was a very special time right then. You know, a neighbor came over before the whole home group showed up. The guy's name was John. I'll never forget. We sat down at the table and Pat says, Robert, get your big book. And I did. He says, give it to John and open to page 63. He says, John, this is the third step prayer. We do this in AA. And so we did that prayer, and here's how it goes. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help. Of thy power, thy love, thy way of life, may I do thy will always. Amen. You know, I believe that prayer and other prayers were answered that day. That day I got up and I prayed on my knees and asked God to help me stay sober, relieve me of the obsession of drink. I did the third step prayer. I went downstairs, got a cup of coffee and read my devotional stuff, daily reflections and other things. I talked to some alcoholics I sponsored. I was getting ready to go to, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. And when tragedy hit, it was just enough serenity to stay sober that day, you know. But my friends and I showed up. God, the power of God was there. And every now and then I hear people say, God won't give you more than you can handle. But I can tell you, God will give you more than you can handle. Otherwise, you wouldn't need God. You know? I mean, I need God. I need God as much today as any other day. So the people all showed up, and so here's an interesting fact. And looking back, you can say, how can anything funny happen? And I don't know if I thought it was funny then, but so I get a call from a guy's sponsor. His name was Brad, and I answer the phone, and he says, "Robert, I'm so sorry." He says, "I've been out drinking." And I said, "Brad, what's going on?" He says, "Where are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm at home right now." I says, "Just stay there, and when you sober up, you just need to go down to NAB because you live near here. Go down to NAB and get a white chip." I closed the phone. I put it in my pocket. It was one of those old flip phones. That was the time frame. And Pat, my sponsor, standing beside me, looks at me and he says, "Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world." I said, "Pat, my son just died." He says, No, I'm not talking about that." He says, "I'm talking about Brad." He said, "If anyone should be drinking, it's you. But you've got a sponsor out there drinking for you. It's good to have a sponsor, you know." I don't know if I laughed at that then, but I've laughed a lot at that now, you know. Sponsors have a way of seeing things that the sponsee cannot see. It's great having a sponsor. So a couple days later, it was a Friday, we buried Stuart. And that day, just a tremendous number of his friends came, my friends came, my former wife's friends. So there was a number of people there to honor Stuart's life. And we celebrate his life. And yet it was still just so awfully painful. And yet, that was the Friday night, and it was Peachtree Corners night, and I went back to AA. That's the first night I'd gone back to AA, and it was the speaker night for the end of the month where you hand out chips and all that, and I know I was on edge, and people knew what had happened, but they were glad I was there, and they, you know, spoke to me. And, you know, a couple things about that whole thing. When I think about Stuart's death, I was powerless over that, absolutely powerless. There's sort of a new level of unmanageability was thrown into the mix, but I was absolutely powerless. But what I had to be concerned about is some people, they face a loss like this, and they're consumed by it. It just takes over their life. That's all they can think about. How can this kind of thing happen to me? Why does this stuff happen? And it just can take over their life. It's almost like an obsession. And I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And the sanity would be that I wouldn't be obsessed with that forever, that I'd be able to go on and continue life. So I made a decision to do something about it. What I did is people had brought stuff by about how to deal with loss by suicide. And there's groups for people who have to learn to deal with loss by suicide. It's led by people who've been through it. There's not a counselor there saying, "You need to do this." But people who've experienced the same problem share what they did to get over it. So I started going to those groups, and certainly I got some relief from that, and I found some of the things that I needed to do to get better through that grief process. Because suicide is highly stigmatized. There's a lot of questions and all sorts of things you ask yourself, and you blame yourself and all that. And I had to get with other people who had learned to deal with it. And so I went to those groups, and after a year and a half or so, they said, "You know, Robert, you seem to communicate effectively. You don't tell people what to do. You share your experience." I sort of learned that here. And they said, "Why don't you start leading those groups?" And before I knew it, I was leading those groups. And I've been doing that for a number of years. And I've been able to also share at suicide conferences and things like that, because suicide has grown even more with the pandemic. It's still every bit as prevalent today as it ever was. And certainly you want to do all you can to prevent it, but when it still occurs, what are you going to do in that postvention stage? And I was grateful that there was someone there for me to help me, and so I try and give back. It's a good way to remember Stuart and tell stories about him that are meaningful. You know, I think about that whole felonies and robbing the drugstore and all that kind of stuff, and that was a real mess. So I came here. Actually, I came here, and someone in this room asked me this question. He says, "Robert, have you ever thought about applying for a pardon for those felonies?" And I thought, "Nope, sure hadn't." And he gave me a few simple ideas about what I could do. And this is in 2007, I believe. And so in 2007, I applied for a pardon. And then in April of 2009, I go out to the mailbox. And since this time, I should mention, since after Stuart died, I ended up getting divorced from my first wife. You know, living with an alcoholic for 20 years is problematic. And then the death of a child is problematic. And so we end up getting divorced. And I met Carrie through recovery, and we got married in 2007. And in 2009, though, I'll never forget. So I go out to the mailbox and applied for the pardon. I got in a letter from the Department of Pardons and Paroles. And so I run inside and say, "Carrie, this is either really good news or really bad news." And sure enough, it was good news. And so I got this pardon. I couldn't believe it. And so I was running around, and it came in on April 9th, the day before my sobriety date. So I go to my home group, and I'm picking up my chip, and I always say, "I've been sober X number of years, but I got pardoned." And so I'm really happy with it. And I went and showed it to my sponsor a few days later. And he took a look at this and he read it closely and he read this one sentence. He says, "Whereas, having investigated the facts material to the pardon application, which investigation established the satisfaction of the board that the pardon applicant is a law-abiding citizen and is fully rehabilitated." He said, "They did not talk with me." Generally, it's good to have a sponsor. You know, I do want to close with a couple of thoughts. You know, when I was at that mental institute, the clinician, if you will, he asked me a question. He said, "Robert, do you think AA will work for you?" And that's a question I really have for everyone in the room. It doesn't matter whether you've been sober a day, a month, or a year, 10 years, or 20 years, or however much. Do you think AA will work for you? It's a really great question. Can we apply the steps in all areas of our lives to help us get over the kinds of problems that are going to come? If you stay sober long enough, there's just problems. There's ups and downs of life. A pandemic comes, for God's sake, you know? Many of us have gotten through that, stayed sober, had to lock down, and now we're back in live meetings, and I'm so glad we're at the live meetings. So those are a couple things that I want you to think about. But AA has made the biggest difference in my life. You know, when I was brand new, I'd go to meetings, and there was a fellow, Bob M. He was really active here, but he was also active at Peachtree Corners, and he'd lead beginners meetings. And he would say, "If you're new, buy a big book and buy 12 and 12, read it and reread it." And I've done that. And I'm going to close by reading a short little passage out of the 12 and 12, which speaks to my story, but it speaks to everyone's story as well. And so here's what it says. It's out of step 12. It says, "Furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeming failure or success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable satisfactions when the brighter, more glaring achievements are denied us?" The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for the many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, they can become facts of life for many more. You know, I'm really grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad to be here with you, and I hope everybody has a great evening. Thank you very much.
Come and give out the chips. Thank you. Yeah. Holiday, I'm a great recovery.
Yeah.
It's good to be clean on this Monday night. And good to see everybody. We have a chip system that marks our time in recovery. And the first chip is a very important chip. If you want to come in and do a new way of life, and the next chip is 30 days.
Too much.
9 days.
Working on it.
9 months.
Favorite speakers. When I came in, I did not think that
sober and joy and pleasure and fun could ever be in things that just didn't think they went together. I thought, okay, maybe I can stop drinking, but my life will be beige.
I picked up a chip in this room, started working the steps. Then about halfway through, I wasn't loving how I felt. Had a couple of rocky months, you know? Like a good alcoholic, you know, I wanted more. I started to love the way I felt, and I started to love myself. And that was brand new information here. So it was just lovely, really a gift. And then I started to sponsor other women. And that is what made good out of all the trashy, horrible things I ever did. Like, you know, gone, like in the 10-step conferences, you know, it's just it's going to be a new life I never dreamed I could have. And I don't know what it looks like from the outside. I have no objective opinion on it, but I think I have the best life in the whole world. I tend to get a little effervescent when I'm speaking, but it's because I'm really excited about it, and my favorite thing to do is to give it away to people who are hurting. Seeing that light come on in those eyes, there's nothing, there's no money that's worth it. I'm so happy to be at this meeting tonight. I love hearing my husband speak. And I've taken up chips, so just thanks, y'all. Thank you, Warren, all for joining the Bishop Speakers meeting tonight.
Promise that you're twisting in the wind.